From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Richmond, California.
San Jose.
Union City.
Eastside. Jackson.
I'm from the Campbell area.
Hayward.
Coming up, we hear from a Caltrain engineer who's seen several suicides on the tracks.
The farther I am from my last one, the closer I am to my next one. It's almost like rolling the dice. It's an awful tragedy.
Then we'll find out what education officials in California could learn from a neighbor to the south, the country of Chile.
I believe that education should be a good provided by the society as a whole. That is to say, by the state.
And we hear how one jazz artist developed her unique sound.
And then you have your body making configurations to enable you to externalize that sound.
That's today on Cross Currents. Stay tuned. In the past 6 weeks, five people have died on Caltrain tracks, hit by trains that couldn't stop in time to avoid them. Every year, an average of 12 people die on Caltrain tracks, and most are suicides. This is a small percentage of suicide deaths each year. Only about 1% of suicides in the U.S. are by train. Caltrain has built 10-foot fences along much of the route, commissioned studies about location and prevention. They've put up signs with suicide hotline numbers along its tracks and partnered with mental health agencies. But it is a tragic problem that persists. And it's not just on Caltrain. In 2011, 700 people died on train tracks nationwide. Suicides are a small percentage of these deaths, but they have serious emotional consequences, both for the loved ones of the people who kill themselves and for the men and women who drive and work on trains. KALW's Julie Kane has the story.
Great day. Caltrain did hit 159. Our passengers called in for somebody who was walking on the track. Must have missed him. I don't know.
Charles is a locomotive engineer for Caltrain. That's not his real name. He asked us not to use it. But he is one of the people who drive the trains between San Jose and San Francisco. He's been working on the railroad for more than 30 years, and for the most part, he loves his job.
I've tried to quit the railroad several times. I don't know if it was in my blood, or I'm a third-generation railroader. So I was always pulled back to the railroad. I like the lifestyle. I like the money. And I've raised a family on railroad.
But there is a part of his job that never gets easier, witnessing people die under the wheels of his trains.
I've had two since January 1st, and that's kind of high for me. I average one a year. But you never know when it's going to happen.
Train engineers like Charles may not know when it's going to happen, but they do know that sooner or later, it is going to happen. Trains aren't like cars. They weigh 400 tons, and you can't just slam on the brakes and stop.
The way I kind of look at it, the farther I am from my last one, the closer I am to my next one. It's almost like rolling the dice, and it's an awful tragedy.
On Caltrain, a typical crew is made up of three people, the engineer and two conductors who work with passengers. When someone is hit, the conductors are the first people to go out on the tracks to find them. The engineer is usually the last one to see that person alive.
It's an interesting thing, though, how in the heat of the battle there, we kind of go on automatic, and it don't sink in until we've been rescued from the scene and we're taken away, and then it sinks in. I've seen people break down afterwards, and, you know, I want to break down, and sometimes my ego and my pride keep me from it, but inside I'm dying.
When they're first hired, crew members are told that bad things might happen on the tracks, and any crew member involved in a death gets paid time off and access to counseling. But not everybody takes advantage of it. Lori Richer is a clinical psychiatrist at UCSF, and she says this kind of emotional trauma isn't necessarily something crews are trained to deal with.
As opposed to first responders, EMS, paramedics, police that come to a scene, they have some degree of emotional preparedness, whereas a train driver doesn't. They witness the suicide. So it's traumatic on a whole different level. So they're not trained or prepared, or it wasn't a motivation in choosing that line of work. So these tragedies happen to them right out of the blue.
Richard says the emotional trauma that can result has a name, post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. It's something we often associate with soldiers coming home from war. Basically, when we're in danger, our adrenaline kicks in and we go into survival mode. The problem is that once the danger is past, we can get stuck in this heightened state, unable to stop reliving the trauma, unable to stop being on the lookout for more danger, and with a strong urge to avoid the place where the trauma happened.
It's difficult because every time I go past the scene of where I've had a fatality, it plays back like a video.
That's the problem for train crews. They can't avoid the place where the death happened. And they can't avoid the fact that another one could happen at any time.
Your first nature is to crawl in your hole and just pull the covers over your head. And many people do that. They don't answer the phone after that day. And that's probably the worst thing you can do, because you sit there with that rolling around in your head. It just destroys your sleep for several days.
Richard says the best thing anyone can do after a serious trauma is reach out for help and talk about how they're feeling.
What that does is it validates the response. It helps individuals realize that they're not alone in their response, that in fact it's more common than not to experience some of the symptoms of PTSD. And also, you know, peers provide ideas for how they got support, and it just becomes more, seeking help becomes more acceptable.
Seeking and giving help is something Charles has learned how to do in his long career on the railroad. He talks to friends and a counselor and makes it a point to reach out to other crew members who have also experienced trauma.
Reaching out and to help others has been a good thing for me. I don't get to spend too much time thinking about mine if I'm helping others. Plus, I have a great network of friends who, they prop me up when I can't stand on my own. They help me through these difficult times, and I'm really blessed. I feel like the luckiest man on earth sometimes.
Charles doesn't blame Caltrain for the deaths. Track fatalities are a part of the job all over the world.
You know, Caltrain goes to great lengths to keep that from happening. They have 10-foot fences along the whole line. It's not because of any negligence. It'd be nice to prevent all of it, but that's dreaming. but we're trying. And anything that we can do to have some kind of effect on it, if it saves one life, it's worth it. And that's why I agreed to do this interview. If it saves one person from this, it's a wonderful thing. And I'm honored to be able to do it.
On a warm Saturday afternoon in June, several thousand people are gathered at San Francisco's Fort Mason.
Did you like it, Matt?
It's a sea of blue t-shirts. On the back of each shirt, it reads, "I'll be up all night for," followed by a blank line. People have filled in the words, "I'll be up all night for my mother, for my father, for my Uncle Tim." Other people have written in names, followed by dates. Dates of birth, and dates of death.
Are you ready to walk the overnight? Woo! Are you ready to take our cause to the streets of San Francisco?
Yeah!
The annual Out of the Darkness Walk is a suicide awareness event. It's held in different cities all around the country. Tonight, people will spend all night walking the streets of San Francisco, raising money for suicide prevention and research. There are a lot of individuals and a lot of families. And this year, there's also a group of 8 Caltrain staff members.
I am April McGeegad, and I just recently moved to the Bay Area from Virginia in January, and I worked for a commuter rail system similar to Caltrain, except we did not have anywhere near the same number of fatalities in Virginia as we have here.
McGee Gadd is leading tonight's Caltrain walkers.
It was probably right around the third fatality that we had here at Caltrain since my moving here that I decided that I needed to find a way to cope and deal with it.
Ted Urich is also on the Caltrain team.
We've kind of taken a position of, instead of not talking about it more. And hopefully this, you know, helps promote that point of view that you should be more open about depression and suicide as things that happen.
Since the night of the walk, the Caltrain team has raised $12,000 to help people who have lost loved ones to suicide. Donations are still coming in. McGee Gadd says the walk gives people a sense that there's support, that there are others who understand what it's like to go through a suicide and who want to offer help.
You know, it is a sense of sadness that you know that this is a person that, you know, has chosen quite a tragic way to end their life. And you wonder about their family and you wonder about, you know, the people that they're leaving behind. You know, it's not just another delay. It's somebody's family member.
For Cross Currents, I'm Julie Kane.
If you or someone you know is in suicidal crisis or emotional distress, please call 1-800-273-TALK right away. That's 1-800-273-8255. Help is there for you and you're not alone. You can also read about suicide warning signs and prevention strategies at suicidepreventionlifeline.org/get help. All of this information is also on our website at klw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Last week, student members of Communities United for Restorative Youth Justice from the Bay Area traveled to Sacramento to rally at the state capitol. They were there to support Assemblyman V. Manuel Perez's resolution to establish a statewide student and youth bill of rights to improve education. Here's Assemblyman Perez speaking at that rally.
And we need to make sure that we invest in you. And we invest in you by creating opportunities with you, as opposed to incarcerating you, or pushing you out of schools, or suspending and expelling you. So today's efforts, first and foremost, is to let the legislature know that you do have a voice.
It's been a tumultuous year for California universities, especially the UCs. Campuses have played host to several protests throughout the year, with students outraged over rising costs. Tuition has risen by more than 300% over the last decade, largely the consequence of drops in state support. Last year, student payments exceeded state contributions for the first time in the system's history. To gain some perspective on the University of California's struggle to serve its students and on students' demands for their rights, we're going to look to the South, actually just about as far south as we can go. Education costs in Chile are second only to the United States. Both countries have pronounced income inequality. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development says that of 31 mostly rich countries, Chile has the most unequal distribution of wealth in the world. The U.S. is in fourth place. And in Chile, KALW's Carolina Hidalgo says rising education costs have helped entrench that economic gap.
I'm a young Chilean journalist. I graduated in 2009 from one of my country's state-sponsored universities in the capital, Santiago. It's a fine school, has a strong reputation. But in recent years, these universities have suffered severe losses in public subsidies. Now, just like in California, they are mostly financed by students' fees. And just like in California, that sparked protests.
Yo de partida creo que
I believe that education should be a good provided by the society as a whole, that is to say, by the state. And in that sense, public education is a tool we have to ensure that there will be equality of opportunity.
Giorgio Jackson has been one of the main leaders of the Chilean student movement, which has drawn tens of thousands of people to the streets. Aside from his activism, he's currently completing his degree in engineering, and he has a vision for what higher education should be.
La educación superior cumple una función.
And public higher education must contribute to our society by creating knowledge and applying to real life. That is the main triumph of the 21st century, the added value we can give to the economy. And that is what's at stake. If we want higher education to be private, individual, or if we want it to be collective, of a society as a whole. In that sense, public education plays an important role by generating free thinking and being at the forefront of innovation and application of that knowledge.
Jackson's perspective is on the Chilean system, but it recalls the original vision for the University of California. In the 1960s, it was the biggest public university in America, and Clark Kerr was its president.
The university is being called upon to educate previously unimagined numbers of students, to respond to the expanding claims of national service, to merge its activities with industry as never before.
Here is Kerr, as captured in the documentary film Berkeley in the 60s.
Characteristic of this transformation is the growth of the knowledge industry, which is coming to permeate government and business, and to draw into it more and more people raised to higher and higher levels of skill.
50 years later, that system is transforming.
The tendency of states to disinvest from public universities is part of what I see as a larger issue in the United States about the question of common good.
Gibor Basri is the Vice Chancellor for Equity and Inclusion of UC Berkeley.
When you pull away from the common good, what happens is people who aren't affluent lose the services, and the people who are affluent get them privately. And this is a philosophical question. So the students have been asking for a return to the common good, but in order to achieve that, we have to have a return to that way of thinking by the public.
I come from a middle-class family. I was not able to get financial aid, and my education cost up to $700 per month, quite a lot in a country where our average household income is just $1,000 per month. Giorgio Jackson notes this is the hardship for many hopeful college students in Chile.
Solamente los que tienen muchos recursos pueden financiar eso. Y es muy injusto eso.
Only the families of many resources can pay for that, and it is really unfair.
He says it creates a negative ripple effect for students in struggling economies.
I think we have to start breaking down individualism. This idea that education is a private good and an individual good, and when we all start to understand that the education of others is good for me and it is good for us as a whole, in that moment, it makes sense that we all must finance it because it is important to all of us. That's when the issue of taxes comes up, especially for the government of California, which is always in favor of lower taxes.
The Public Policy Institute of California has found that 62% of Californians think public education in the state is going in the wrong direction. But 52% are not willing to pay higher taxes to maintain current funding. The result is thousands of UC graduates leave school in debt. Jackson has a solution.
There are ways to fix this that are a little more fair than paying for your degree or getting a fixed interest rate loan. Instead, the student should pay back the state, which I think he should do because the state pays for his education after his studies by way of a tax that is proportional to his income.
That's one way. California is taking its own steps. Again, UC Berkeley Vice Chancellor Gibor Basri.
Right now, the way our financial aid system works, we have, whenever anyone pays tuition, a third of it immediately goes into the financial aid pot.
Berkeley has a plan for families whose gross income ranges from $80,000 to $140,000 a year. It caps undergraduate fees at 15% of parent income, and the school is doing more to help California's middle-class students.
As we have increased the number of international students, for example, that has given us a little more to work with in terms of starting to help the middle class.
However, Basri says that if the state disinvestment in higher education continues, it could jeopardize the original purpose of the University of California.
At Berkeley, we feel like we have turned the corner on the question of how to stabilize our budget, but of course it doesn't look like it did before. It has a much stronger student component, which you can view as private if you like, because the individual user is paying instead of the taxpayer. So unless the state turns around, that's going to stay that way, and we have to find other sources as well, and they may be from private foundations, donors, companies, whatever. But then the question is, what do you do with the money, and do you continue your public purpose, and do you continue to serve the public in the sense that Berkeley does?
In my home country of Chile, the government is trying to invest more state money into its universities. But politicians are having trouble finding the funds. Here in California, lawmakers and administrators have shown they have the will to keep public higher education accessible. The question is whether they can find a way to keep covering the costs. Until it's sustainable, middle-class students like me will struggle to pay for our education. In Berkeley, I'm Carolina Hidalgo for Cross Currents.
So do you think Governor Jerry Brown's proposed tax hikes to save education are popular? What do people in your circles think? Post on our Facebook page. It's KALW News. Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba. And now for some artery, cultural coverage that's jazzy. All great jazz musicians have a unique sound, but what is that tone and how do you develop it? That's the starting point of a conversation between Jazz Perspectives producer Reese Ehrlich and Sweet Sue Terry, a saxophonist who'll be performing in the Bay Area this week.
Great jazz musicians all have their own distinct tone. It's that hard-to-describe sound that makes Charlie Parker, for example, instantly recognizable. Sweet Sue Terry is no Charlie Parker, but hey, who is? But she has developed a wonderful open tone with her own style. Terry, who plays sax, flute, and clarinet, says developing your own tone is a work in progress. Most musicians start by listening to someone they really admire and try to recreate that tone. It's a little like imitating a foreign accent. You listen to someone from another country speaking English and then try to imitate that with your own voice.
When you imitate an accent, you know, when you want to tell an Irish joke or something like that, or you want to imitate an English accent, whatever it is, and then there's certain things that you have to do with your tongue, that you have to do with the way that you form the words in order for that accent to be discernible. Yes, indeed, you could have many, many different kinds of accents in your tone. Eventually, what will happen is your body and all the resonant cavities that are inside your body that are working with you physically to produce the sound. You have the sound in your head, and then you have your body making configurations to enable you to externalize that sound. So you've got the diaphragm, the larynx, the palate, the rib cage, the lungs, all of these parts of the body, the tongue, the skull. Everything is going to move in a certain way to enable you to make that sound.
Terry is also a talented jazz composer. For many musicians, the process of composing is quite mysterious. Terry is better than most in explaining what goes through her head.
I wouldn't say that I have any one process that I subscribe to. I utilize various processes. Often I'm inspired to write a tune based on a motif that comes to me, a melodic motif. And that melodic motif I then proceed to develop and embellish, and it moves on from there into other motifs.
Terry explains how she used one motif, a snippet of sound, to compose a tune called The Troubadours.
The Troubadours, coming from this initial motif, which came to me, which was this one. So that was it. It was just those two bars. And I just kind of fell in love with those intervals and fell in love with that line. And I played it over and over again.
Whether as composer or performer with her own unique tone, Sweet Sue Terry continues to make great contributions to the world of jazz. I'm Reese Ehrlich with a perspective on jazz.
Sue Terry and pianist Peggy Stern performed July 1st in Half Moon Bay at the Bach Dynamite and Dancing Society and July 2nd at Oakland's Yoshi's. To hear more of Reese Ehrlich's jazz perspectives, you can visit jazzcorner.com. And we'd like to hear what music you like to hear. Hit us up on our Facebook page, KALW News. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. In every show, we ask you, the listeners, for your opinions on our stories or to share your experiences with us. Nina Frankel called us because a story from last week resonated with her. It was from our public radio partners, Fronteras, discussing the Mexican presidential elections, and we asked you what other presidential elections from around the world you're following. Here's what she had to say.
First voice message.
I do follow a lot of other countries' elections because I work sometimes as an electoral observer, and I've worked in several countries to help them set up elections. And as an international aid worker, that can make or break opportunities for jobs, and it is a big event, an election. Most countries take their elections more seriously than in the United States. Citizens are more involved, and so it's a joy. I'm following the Mexican election with interest, and elections are really exciting. I just wish the American civil society could get as revved up about them as in some of the countries where I work, where it's nascent and people take it seriously. And in some cases, change even happens.
End of message.
Our story about urban raccoons and the Bay Area's wild animal population got the attention of another listener who didn't leave his name, but here's what he had to say.
Next message.
I used to drive a cab, and I would drive all night long, and something that I used to encounter, like when crossing Golden Gate Park late at night, I used to see coyotes, and I thought, God, I wouldn't want to live around here, around the park. And then there was the time when I had a group of people in the car. It was late night. They were actually partiers that I picked up south of Market, and I was taking them out to near, just off of Sloat, not far from the zoo. And the first time in my life, and I grew up in this city, the first time in my life I've ever seen a fox, you know, crossing the roadway, crossing Sunset. And I had a car full of passengers who witnessed it, so it was not an illusion. Yes, so coyotes, definitely, and one time a fox. The animal. Okay, thanks. Bye.
End of new messages.
We love to hear from our listeners, especially when they leave us their names. So leave a message on our feedback line. It's 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106, and we might air it on the show. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Buffy Elmendares, Zoe Bresny, Julie Kane, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Fatima Duran, Nina Gensler-Debs, Lupe Hernandez, Angela Johnston, RTM's Konohovs, Holly J. McDeed, Erica Mu, Nina Nicole Marinte, Mary Reese, Seth Samuel, Stephen Short, and Isaac Silk. Today's show is engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. Thanks to City Car Share, which provides an alternative transportation option for our reporters. City Car Share is online at citycarshare.org. And thank you. We are listener-supported radio. This music is written and performed by a 21-year-old who goes by the title Girl Named T. There's a possibility you've heard this song because it was used on the MTV program called Awkward. If you'd like to hear all of it, there's a good chance she'll be playing it Thursday at Club Vitus in Oakland. She's the opening act starting at about 9:30. Before, but now you're here, who could ask for more? Porcupine, been jealous of its vines. My skin's so thin, people slip right in. But now you're here, I can feel again. I'm falling for you. I've got everything I need between your. And we'll leave you with another edition of My Mixtape, where people bring us songs that mean something special to them. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.
My name's Lotus Yi Fong, and I live in San Francisco. And the special song was my mother's favorite. It's called Rose, Rose, I Love You.
Rose, Rose, I love you with an aching heart.
When I hum that to any of my friends in Chinatown, they recognize it immediately, and then they go and get me the CD for it, because it represents the time in China, Shanghai, when Westerners were first in China in the late 1800s, but then the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And I think we need to go back to those days and try to understand it better, because I think East-West relations are very important in the world these days, and we need to go back to the history and kind of understand who wrote those songs and what they meant in those days.
Almond eyes, fragrant and slender, neath tropical skies. I must cross the seas again and never see you more. Way back to my home on a distant shore.
All my life I shall remember.